Abdul-Gul, I think, comes out of this stronger as well. On the one hand, I think his position within the party has probably shifted, not necessarily to his advantage as a result of Erdogan's having become stronger. But I think there's no question that his moral authority within the party and Turkish politics in general has been enhanced by the very classy and dignified way he dealt with the interruption of his presidential candidacy. And the question is, where does he go from here? I don't think it's possible to say today. The MHP is a winner. It's always better to be in than out if you're a politician. They're now in. But they look to me, sort of the day after, like a permanent 14% party. And I'm not sure that there's a lot of scope for growth there, barring something fairly dramatic on the Iraq-Turkey border in the days ahead. I think that Turkey's relationship with Europe will probably be a winner as a result of yesterday's result. The AKP has had difficulty both because of European attitudes and because the things that they would have had to do to change those attitudes have been difficult to do in the run-up to an election. Now they have a mandate to go back to what I think will be a genuine commitment to carrying out the reforms that have achieved their candidacy 2 years ago and will be necessary to regenerate it today. There's got to be a strong inclination on the part of Mr. Erdogan to determine whether or not the new generation of European leaders like Sarkozy and Merkel will be more responsive to a Turkish leadership that has such a strong, clear mandate for the next 5 years. Stay tuned on that one. And I think that there's potential for improvement and growth in Turkey's relationship with Russia as well. That's a relationship that has sort of grown without people in this town having followed it as closely as they might have in recent years. The personal relationship between Putin and Erdogan is an important one. The commercial and business relationships have become extremely important and are dwarfing the similar relationships with this country. And my guess is that you'll see that continue to grow in the years ahead. Losers. The Republican People's Party, to gain 1.5-2% in a year when their issue, secularism, was supposed to be the issue, to gain 1.5-2% after having achieved what was arguably their only political success in recent history, which was to stop the Abdul-Gul presidential candidacy in April, to get only 1.5-2% better than 2002, when the military had very dramatically put the thumb on their scales last April, I would guess they probably deserved worse than they got. And so they should maybe take some satisfaction with having marginally improved their gains. But under their current leadership, it's hard to see where they go from here. The military. It's hard to see if this is a blessing in disguise for the Turkish military, where that blessing might be. They committed a good deal of authority and credibility on April 27th of last year with what one has to assume had been the anticipation that would make a difference in the elections to take place later in the year. It seems to have done so, but perhaps not in the way that they expected. And I think that it will be harder for them to consider that kind of intervention in the future after the results that we've seen yesterday. The center-right, to the extent that it still exists, it's AKP territory at this point. The 5% that Mr. Ağar's party generated, I think, will not be enough to sustain that party unless they can do something fairly dramatic in terms of leadership or message. I don't think that Mesut Yılmaz is the man who's going to lead the center-right back to power anytime soon, even though he's now a member of parliament. The Turkish left, I think, you know, they will be represented in the new parliament as a function of the deal that they made with the Republican People's Party. But that's probably an accident because of the structural arrangements, and I'd be surprised if they are a major factor in the future. I'm tempted to put the U.S.-Turkey relationship in the losers category. Instead, I'm going to make it the first subject of the questions on the table category. And the reason I say that, picking up on some points that Bulent was making, was that I think it's probably the case, unfortunately, that the AK leadership, rightly or wrongly, believes that the United States tacitly backed what happened on April 27th by their initial response. And I think they probably believe, again, rightly or wrongly, reports that the United States delayed action on the PKK in order not to give the AKP an advantage. I emphasize these aren't necessarily true, and I don't necessarily believe them, but I think that there are a lot of people in AKP and their supporters who do. We are in the final 18 months of the Bush administration. It may be that the new government will not have a strong incentive to invest a lot of its capital. That's what elections produce, right? In a U.S. administration that is already heading for the door. Add that to the fact that the issues that are out there over the next 6 to 8 months are issues, largely regional issues, where U.S. And AKP instincts are likely to be in tension to some extent. Other questions. Moulin said it. Chanka is the next big question. Will this political leader, with no small ego, having come through with a bigger-than-expected victory, go for a consensus candidate that will be seen as a consensus candidate outside of the AKP? Stay tuned. It's going to be interesting to see. There are some pretty hair-raising scenarios which could occur if he decides it needs to be an AKP person, and the opposition parties are not prepared to enter the hall to give him the quorum he needs to proceed. You could have additional elections, as little as I suspect anybody wants it. But the stakes here are high. I think he did overplay his hand last spring. I hope he's learned something from that, and I hope that, you know, a month and a half from now, we will have put the issue of the presidential succession behind us. But I think as we sit here on the day after, that cannot be assumed. The question of the European Union's receptivity to accelerating or salvaging the dialogue with Turkey in the short to midterm, I think has to be a big question. As I suggested, I think that the AKP leadership's tendency will be to try to revive that. I'm not sure that they will find that the Europeans are ready or able for it at this point. And finally, just to wrap up, the whole question of regional diplomacy, including energy diplomacy, it's not clear to me, as I suggested earlier, that the commonality of tactical perceptions will enable us to do the kind of work that the common, genuine, I think, commonality of objectives would lead one to hope for. So I'll stop there, and we'll take questions.
Before we proceed to the questions, I'll just add a couple of things. I wanted to see what was on covered and what I might be able to add before we proceeded to the questions. About Tayyip Erdogan, until somebody emerges in Turkey with the kind of charisma and the populist touch that he has, he looks set to govern Turkey for the foreseeable future. Who would bet against him 5 years from now, assuming that he still wants to be prime minister? You know, clearly his opponents don't have it at the moment, but one day somebody's going to emerge and with that kind of combination that he has. He didn't emerge out of nowhere. It took him a long time to get that. Maybe there's somebody on the left. But what is the left? You know, the Republican People's Party is has been outdoing the nationalist parties on the EU, on Northern Iraq, and so on. So maybe we're going through a phase in which the Social Democrats will redefine themselves, as presumably will the nationalists. Second point, what was missing in this campaign was a discussion about the greater religiosity, the greater observance on the part of the Turks, and the extent to which the secular system bequeathed by Kemal Atatürk can accommodate this. You know, in the last update, I said I hoped that there would be discussion of this in the election. Of course, you know, that was far too optimistic. It just did not happen. Almost half of the people have voted for Tayyip Erdogan, but then the other half have not. If this, I don't think it is, but if this was the product of polarization, then, you know, half of the people are still skeptical, presumably, of Tayyip Erdogan's commitment to the secular system, which is the archstone of the Turkish Republic. And his enemies presumably hate him just as much as they did before, even though those who love him obviously love him a little bit more as well. That discussion has to take place because this ad hoc cohabitation between a rigorously secular, almost Jacobin system bequeathed by Ataturk and a society that he clearly could not have envisioned back in the 1920s, which is what we have. Many people defining themselves as religious, many people supporting people who are as religious as they are, even if they do not want to overthrow the secular system. That discussion is still out there. Now, last night, something interesting happened. I was on the BBC TV, and a gentleman before me was being interviewed by Johnny Diamond, the former BBC reporter who was here and then subsequently in Istanbul. And he said, the counter-revolution is a one, and this is a sad day for Turkey. I can't remember who he is. A Turkish gentleman doing an interview from Istanbul. And he said, the only way out is for the military to intervene. Now, clearly, this is something that I don't think that anybody should be talking about in the immediate aftermath of the elections. But let us remember that the military hoped, exactly as Marx said, by its intervention to tip the balance against a party that they didn't particularly like and said that they were worried about whose actions they were worried about. Now, if the parliamentary and therefore the democratic means of challenging this party are excluded, and you still do not like this party and what it's doing, in spite of everything that it says with respect to its moderation, then there's only one alternative for you. And it is one alternative that people in Turkey, notwithstanding how little support for it there is, may still come back to. Now, this is worth noting immediately after the elections, just to exclude it as we proceed. But that option will still be discussed by some people, although one hopes that this is, you know, the confirmation that Turkey will be sticking to the democratic process as we proceed forward. Finally, this is Tayyip Erdogan's party, as I said, and just to underline something that Ambassador Paris said, the four people who set up this party in 2001 were Tayyip Erdogan, Abdullah Gül, Abdülhatif Şener, and Bülent Arınç. Şener decided not to run, although he stayed within the party. Bülent Arınç's powers have been very much clipped because of the selection of the through the selection of the candidates, and remembering that he had run for the speakership against the wishes of Tayyip Erdogan, had won. That clearly is not an option that's out there for him. That leaves two, Tayyip Erdogan and Abdullah Gül. Tayyip Erdogan was primus inter pares when the party was established in 2001. Now he's head and shoulders over everybody else. Gül is obviously the number two. But there is a question mark, as was said, as to what he does. Does he go for the presidency, reopening perhaps all the issues that were raised before? Does he stay as deputy prime minister or foreign minister? This is going to be the first cabinet that Tayyip Erdogan will be establishing as really his own, because he wasn't allowed to run in 2002. The government was formed by Gül. He came in through by-election, became prime minister, made minimal changes, really, over 4 years, much less than most people have done as prime minister. This is going to be his first cabinet, and we'll see what kind of stamp he puts on it. A disaster in these elections would have been his disaster, and he acknowledged it by saying that he would resign if he did not come back as a single-party government. Therefore, the victory is, to a great extent, as Marx said, his. So we will see what Tayyip Erdogan's next 5 years are going to be like. With that, I'll stop, and the floor is open for debates. First, Rob Friedman, and then the lady next to you, and I'll come back to Carol.
Well, if my analysis is correct, that most of the gains that he's made are in the center of Turkish politics, it seems to me that that both gives him some ballast to resist pressures to do things that might create social tensions and get him quickly into a face-off with those who would resist that kind of a direction. Even in a situation where he was, as Bülent has suggested, much less in control of his party or his parliamentary group than he is today and from this point on, His approach to these kinds of things, by and large, is pretty pragmatic. He did, on occasion, come under pressure to try to move in this direction. When he met opposition, when it was significant enough, he simply backed off. So that seems to me to establish the baseline for his conduct into the future. And my guess would be that he would be, and can be, more pragmatic about this sort of thing with the kind of majority that he now commands and the control of the party that he has managed to enhance.
I think, just to add quickly to the debate, sure, the arc is in the center, but the center's shifted. So the kind of concerns that, that you've raised are important. Now, back in 1950, let us remember, the DP had won the elections by saying that it was going to allow greater religious observance. It allowed the Arabic call to prayer, it allowed the pilgrimage, and so on, and was able to pick up the votes of those who felt that the state had gone too far in suppressing religious observance. We saw that subsequently with the Justice Party, with Demiral Özal, in the 80s, and now I think it's gone a little bit further with Tayyip Erdogan and his party. Now the question is, does he go further? You know, a lot of people who voted for him want him to move on the headscarf issue, on the religious schools. But if he does, then those who are willing to give them the benefit of the doubt, now that he is in the center, as Mark Reiker says, you know, will be suspicious. So, you know, if he moves forward to satisfy his those who voted for him, he enrages the others. So he's got to steer a careful path. And in the meanwhile, to repeat what I said before, he and his party have to contribute to this new national consensus to emerge on how a rigidly secular system can be adjusted to accommodate the greater religiosity on the part of the people. The lady sitting next to you, please. Could you identify yourself?
Yes, Francine Kiefer, the Christian Science.
Crack at this first.
Well, one of the articles that I read this morning when I was sort of looking at reactions around the world was a Lebanese newspaper, which started off by saying something like, you know, yesterday morning the Turkish prime minister, chief of staff, and president all went off to vote and none of them knew what the result was going to be. Isn't this refreshing in our part of the world? So, you know, I think it's always easy, and this administration in Washington has frequently fallen victim to this, to suggest that, you know, Turkey is a model that has universal applicability throughout the Muslim world. It clearly doesn't. Turks would reject it. So would most of the countries that are the subject of those kinds of comparisons. But it is something that's pretty remarkable. And to the extent that a party that comes from a clear Islamic background, even though it doesn't currently define itself in those terms, can come out of a period like the one between April 27th and yesterday with a reinforced majority and be able to take office and regain stewardship of the country for 5 years in local terms is pretty remarkable and has to give heart to those who would like to see the country move in that direction, their countries move in that direction in the future.
I'm always suspicious when questions are whether Turkey is a model come up, because, you know, we had a model that almost collapsed or seemed as if it was collapsing back in April. So in terms of being able to take that and apply it elsewhere, and frankly, I've been skeptical about it. And secondly, you know, the Turks themselves are looking to be part of Europe and are uncomfortable with the idea of being compared to their neighbors to the south, notwithstanding the close business relations and so on, not least because Mr. Erdogan has lived through the experience of with Mr. Erbakan looking to the Arab world and all the suspicions that were raised in the West about him. So I think he's going to be extremely careful as to how he steers that course. Carol McDonald.
Two somewhat related questions. The first one is technical. Is there any way in which you perceive that the new parliament can push up the referendum on direct election, or is it incontrovertible that the direct election amendment will apply to the subsequent presidential election and not this one? Related to that, if it stays in parliament and AK needs a couple more votes, quite a few actually, and it reaches out to the Kurds, the independents, the price of that? Do you go back to the 2005 speech that the answer to the Kurdish situation is more democracy, and do you make some concessions that the EU is encouraging? Does that say, well, there will be no incursion in northern Iraq? What does it mean if you still need to put together votes to elect a president? Where do you see those votes coming from?
The first one's easy, because Tayyip Erdogan himself addressed it and said it will be this parliament that's coming into being that will elect the president. It will be the one after, presumably in 7 years' time, unless you accelerate the process. One can think of ways of accelerating the process. Somebody Tayyip Erdogan nominates is elected somehow through a compromise. And by the way, I believe the compromise will occur with somebody within AK. Tayyip Erdogan will be loath to accept anybody from outside AK, but he may negotiate, discuss getting the opposition to support somebody from within AK. So you get that person to resign, and then you can have early elections, by which time you might have been able to push the referendum, which is now being cleared by the Constitutional Court. But it will be this parliament that will have to choose or not choose within the next 30 days. Now, talking about having to steer a careful course, he has to do the same thing on the Kurdish issue, just as he does with religiosity, not to alienate the secularists who are worried about him. He's been very, very, very careful in what he's been saying and what he's been doing on the Kurdish issue. He's been his rhetoric has toughened against Barzani, against the Iraqi Kurds, and he's been taking whack at the independent Kurdish MPs every time that he thought that they had crossed the line. Leyla Zana, for example, talked about the need for a federal system, and immediately there was a reaction from AK against this. Now, if he were let's just think about what might have happened if he had not got enough votes to form a government, but he'd had to go to the Kurdish independence. That would have been a problem. And even though he can now form the government, if he has to go back to them on any important issue, immediately his enemies, led by Bakhchili, will say, see, you know, this is what he wanted to do all along, destroying the country, and so on. I think he'll be careful. I don't think he'll ever go back to the 2005 line. I just don't believe it, because he seems to have established a position on this issue that I think he's going to find it very difficult to back away from. I may be wrong, but I think he's going to stay where he is more or less on this, which will disappoint the Europeans, who want him to go a lot further on this. But before any of that, he has to decide whether he's going to go into northern Iraq. And frankly, if he does, he's damned because of all the consequences, diplomatic and military, that will ensue. And damned if he doesn't, because from within, not least the military, he will be facing criticism.
Well, if you do the math, and with the caveat that these are incomplete returns, you add 340 seats to 23 Kurdish seats, you get real close. There are four other independent deputies. You get to 367. So, I mean, conceivably, you could get a supermajority with all of the independents and AK, given the current numbers. As Bulent has suggested, that would, A, it would be difficult to get the non-Kurdish independents to go along with the Kurdish independents, and B, it probably wouldn't be very smart in terms of the perception of what you would be trying to do with which partners. I think Erdogan is too good a politician to go in that direction, and Bulent's absolutely right. The Turkish Kurds haven't done much for him lately since he put his hand out, and no one emerged as an interlocutor on that set of issues several years ago. What was the first question? In terms of the presidency, I mean, I agree with everything Bulent just said about the presidency, but if Erdogan is determined to get someone from his party into Çankaya, I'm not as certain as you seem to be that the MHP and CHP are prepared to accept an AKP president. And if they're not, there's going to be a problem. And if there's a problem, you could deadlock. And if you deadlock, you could go to new elections, which would take place after a referendum in October. And, you know, it's it's when I said hair-raising scenarios, this is what I had in mind. It would be a very high-risk proposition for all of the actors, again, to go down this path.
Including Ock.
Maybe especially Ock, since they're in a pretty good position right now. But, you know, on the 23rd of July, you can't rule this out at this point.
Other questions? Black Hughes, and then Mark Fishman.
This is a question for Mark. You briefly touched on this in your initial remarks, but I want you to a bit elaborate on that. What should be the, or how does the U.S. administration should read the outcome of these elections? And I'm not asking, you know, as a short-term question, not only this administration, but in the long term. I mean, we all know that there are some groups, some circles here who are trying to portray AKP in a certain way. And now that we have this clear victory, how does the U.S. administration or how should the U.S. administration read the outcome of these elections? Thank you.
Well, Doug, correct me if I'm wrong, but the only statement I've seen thus far, and in advance of the noon briefing, which takes place in 45 minutes, is Matt Brise's initial suggestion that this is a success for Turkish democracy. I think those are the words he used. That tells you only that it's a success for Turkish democracy. But I think you will find that the administration will be supportive, welcoming, positive about this result, will not seek to try to go back to April 27th, or try to explain what they meant at various points of the discussion on what happened April 27th, and we'll look forward. And I would guess that Condoleezza Rice will call Abdullah Gül and that the president will call Erdogan and congratulate them. And the question on my mind is not whether the United States will seek to stitch this relationship back together and carry it forward into a period where there's going to be a lot of heavy lifting in that region and where we'll need Turkey. It's the extent to which this experience will leave a frisson of perhaps wariness on the part of the current, the new leadership as to what's the point. I think if they get beyond that, they'll realize there's a lot of good reasons to continue, better reasons to work with the United States than not to work with the United States. But, you know, I think that this has had an impact on perceptions, which you'd be nuts to ignore.
You know, your question was to Ambassador Paris, but let me just add something. When Tayyip Erdogan and his party were elected in 2002, Bush was in the second year of his presidency. And now he's got another 5 years ahead of him, and it's Bush who's on limited time. So as Tayyip Erdogan thinks in terms of a relationship with the United States, he has to look beyond the Bush administration, perhaps reach out even more to the Democrats who now have the Hill and may even have the White House. So in terms of thinking about how to fix or, you know, or put on a new footing, if you like, or build on the relationship over the next 18 months, maybe we should think in terms of not just the next 18 months, but the 5 years ahead, during which, barring a major surprise, Erdogan and his party are going to be in office, but there will be a change of administration at this end.
And one other factor we shouldn't forget, unfortunately, there is a resolution out there ready to be fired. And, you know, there are some in Turkey who may feel that if that's going to happen anyway, why spend a lot of time rebuilding this relationship when it's going to incinerate when that occurs?
And the word was that Nancy Pelosi, who does have control over the agenda, had actually refrain from putting that on the congressional agenda for vote, even though the signatories of the resolution had exceeded 218, was because she did not want to do anything before the elections. Well, the elections are out of the way, and it's entirely possible that she might bring it up even before they go off for recess in the summer, although it seems unlikely because there are so many other things on the agenda. Ömer Taşpınar had his hand up.
Question about the how we should see the military's position. Mark, you said that you would place the military in the category of losers in this analysis. Do you think the military itself sees it that way? The military being an institution that is not monolithic in Turkey, I wonder whether there is an alternative view, the way they could look at what happened. Surely AK Party has won, and that's not very good news for them, but in the larger frame of things, they had two goals when they issued the declaration of 27th of April. They did not want an AK Party president. at least one whose wife is wearing the headscarf. On that front, that mission is accomplished. The second thing is they're concerned about an Islamic agenda in Turkey. They're concerned about the fact that AK Party may have, may be nurturing a hidden agenda. The way AK Party responded to the military's memorandum was basically to distance itself from its political Islamic wing, from Milli Görüş, by basically bringing in new faces, which appear to be much more moderate. Now, in the spirit of how Turkey works, why we have such a moderate Islamic movement, I think the military may be seeing this is how the model works. We step in. That's how Islam becomes more moderate. We have to keep doing this because there is no strong opposition. The elections have confirmed that the opposition is very fragmented in Turkey. And I'm not sure if the military will decide to just step off and say we played our role, or to the contrary, they can say, well, this is what we do, and we have to keep playing the opposition because that's how we moderate, that's how we tame this dangerous political Islam.
Look, the workings of the Turkish military are remind me of the task that I had when I used to be a criminologist. You know, you don't necessarily get a straight answer, and it's not always obvious. So I'm not going to try to examine the motives or long-term strategy of Turkey's military, for whom I have a lot of respect and among whom I have a lot of friends. I tend to agree with you that if you were looking at this in terms of sort of day after, what did we get out of this? And if the objective was to keep AK from putting its person in the presidency in April, that worked. You know, secular parties, the constitutional court, military succeeded in stopping Abdullah Gül from becoming president. Whether or not they'll keep AKP out of the presidency, we'll see. I mean, that's how you could get to the kind of hair-raising scenario that I was just describing. If the other parties in parliament are going to deny AK a quorum, if they put up one of their members, this is going to get very interesting very quickly. So as I look at this kind of objectively and from a distance of 3,000 miles, I would be surprised if the kind of sophisticated, okay, we got them where we want them mindset is the prevalent one today among secular Turks. I don't think that they feel that this is a good day after result, all things being considered. Has it moderated? Has one of the results of this been an AK that looks more centrist and moderate? Yes. I'm just not sure that the cause and effect chain that you've described is the way that it really happened or is likely to happen in the future.
You know, it's interesting that Rushik Tolon, the retired ex-general, one of the group of ex-generals who've been so active in the opposition to Tayyip Erdogan and the party, was asked about whether the polarization was responsible for the victory. And his response was, well, the leaders of the other parties were simply incompetent, and they're trying to cover up their own incompetence by talking about this polarization. So the anti-AK group seems to have fragmented, so it'll be interesting to see what other generals like Eri Ruh and others say. But given the fact that Tolon was very much part of this group, it almost seems as if there is no coherent post-election plan on the part of his opponents. We knew that before, but I think we now got confirmation through statements like this, that they don't quite know what to do in order to oppose that. And then I go back to what I talked about, this mysterious meeting between Tayyip Erdogan and Büyükhanet. What exactly was it that they agreed on? What did they disagree on? And how will that make its mark on the civilian-military relationship in the next 5 years? Or at least the part of it that Büyükhanet will be presiding over, which is the next 12 months. Other questions, please? At the back. Can you identify yourself?
Yeah.
we hear a lot about these Anatolian tigers. But it wasn't just the Anatolian tigers that that backed this party. The representative Tusiat is here. Tusiat comprises the most powerful Turkish corporations, and they put out a statement welcoming that party victory. As I said in my presentation, both the domestic, the high rollers as well within the domestic investor community, as well as the ones outside, were supportive of this party. Now, what is interesting is the extent to which the small businessmen who were more conservative, more religious, and who were very much who were not part of the business establishment in Turkey, have been successful during the past 20, 30 years, parallel to the mass migration from the small towns into the cities, and they are the backbone of Tayyip Erdogan's supporters. Now, as they get bigger, they become integrated into the system in exactly the same way that the JDP has been integrated. So the question has to be asked, is AK winning because these are becoming more powerful, or are they becoming more powerful because AK is taking care of those who helped it along the way? I think it's a little bit of both. But at the same time, let us not ignore the fact that they, both at the political level, by moving to the center for AK, and its supporters into the larger business community, are becoming integrated in Turkey, and surely that's a good thing.
Actually, you both touched on this a little bit, but I want to elaborate. I would like you to elaborate further on the future of reform in Turkey, the future of democratization, if you will. I think if we look back for about 1 year or 1.5 years, we would see that AK Party's game plan then was first to keep MHP out of the parliament, and second, to be on the good side of the military so that they could get Mr. Erdogan or whomever they wanted as the president. They did two things. They developed this very nationalistic discourse, I guess, to compete for the nationalist vote with the MHP and to keep the MHP out. They also backed away in incidents like Şemdinli and others, where the military really chose to speak up. Where do you see them going from here, since that now they have this tremendous success at the ballot box? Would they still be trying? I mean, obviously, I think they have already demonstrated that they will try to be on the good side of the military for obvious reasons. But in the midterm, if you will they be going after more democratization, more balance in civil-military relations, and maybe less nationalistic rhetoric? Or will they just see this as the, the reality in Turkey, the realpolitik in Turkey, and they will continue to be kind of a nationalistic and less of a reformist party?
I'm tempted to say that the answer to your question really depends on what happens in the next month over the presidency, because I think that will really set the parameters for the relationship between the military and the ruling party for the succeeding 5 years, 4 years, depending on how the constitution is amended or not amended. If the prime minister is serious about unifying the country, bringing all Turks together, and finding someone who will be generally perceived as a consensus presidential candidate, it seems to me that neither of the two parties that you mentioned has an incentive or much reason to be at odds with one another. I suspect, if I had to guess, that AKP, as part of its attempt to revive the European Union candidacy, that their first inclination would be to do more reform rather than less. And I'm simply not familiar enough technically with where the process of harmonization stands to be able to identify whether or not there are issues in that process that would bring them into odds with the military. But to the extent that the European train was perceived in Turkey as moving forward, my guess is that you will see a regeneration of support for doing those things to the extent that Turkey is perceived to have a partner.
You know, the external... I'll pick this one up, yes, if I may. The external factor was so important for AK. There it was, confronted on in April with obstacles in choosing a president, even though from its own ranks, even though it had over 360 seats. Then we had the military and the constitutional court issues. But once we got into the election campaign, it's quite amazing the extent to which the foreign media, European and American, the consensus of opinion within the European Union was in favor of AK, notwithstanding the resistance on the part of people like Sarkozy and Merkel to Turkey, and even in the U.S., although, as we know in this town, there were some discordant noises. Generally, people were supportive of a trouble-free election and stability as represented by a single-party government. Now, the other side of that coin, having benefited from this, is that AK has to deliver, particularly to the Europeans. There are things that Karen McDullough has talked about that they would want on with respect to the Southeast. Now, I'm not sure that because of the balances that you yourself mentioned in the country, that he's able to move. Nobody talked about Cyprus. Cyprus, the rhetoric has hardened quite a bit. Will he be able to take any steps on Cyprus if General Buchanan and the rest of the TGS are not willing to allow it? And again, Tayyip Erdogan is a very political animal, and he seems to know how far to push things before he backs off. But, you know, again, I'm not sure how he's going to be able to balance all these things as he governs. I think, you know, winning the elections may be the easy part in Turkey. Being the Turkish government is always difficult. And we will see how well he governs in this second phase.
Hasan Mesefezer.
Yeah, it was interesting that Tayyip Erdogan himself addressed this issue, saying that we're going to have a lot of trouble if both the NAP and the independent Kurds get there. And he was mocking, saying, you know, this is going to be a fun time in the National Assembly. Well, I tend to believe it's better for the Kurdish section of the community to be represented inside the National Assembly than for it to be left outside and making its views from outside. The last time this happened was when Leyla Zana and Ahmet Türkit got into the National Assembly through an electoral alliance with the Social Democrats in the 1991 elections. And then we had the various problems that occurred, and some of them went to jail, of course, as we know. I think it's better for them to be there, giving voice to what they believe and wish to state to be the grievances of their region. And if the NAP, Mr. Bahçeli and his colleagues are going to react to it, it's better it be done inside the National Assembly, because that's the democratic way, than for it to be done outside the National Assembly with nooses being thrown around, as was the case with the campaign. At the end, could you identify yourself, please?
Yep. Brian Beery from Europolitics. Just going back to the Cyprus issue. Cyprus is now in the EU, so at any point in time it can use its veto and basically prevent the process of enlargement. What's the view in Turkey? I mean, where do the parties stand on the whole issue? Are there pragmatists who realize that, you know, unless there's some movement on the thing, that it's just going to derail the whole enlargement process? Are all the parties more or less agreed that, you know, they have to stay pretty firm on this issue?
Thank you. I used to do this for a living. Yep. I was actually born in Cyprus, and so I guess there's no way I can avoid this one. Well, let's go back to 2002 when they were elected. This was just before when AK was elected. This was just before the then Secretary General was about to push his ultimately fruitless attempt to force a solution. By the time that Cyprus as a whole, united in as a compromised republic, had come into being, didn't work. The UN initiative failed, and Cyprus, or at least the two-thirds that's internationally recognized in the south, went in as a Cyprus Republic. Now, the JDP initially was very supportive of the settlement. It recognized the importance of getting to a settlement in order to clear the way for its own EU ambitions. And things really came to a head at the Copenhagen summit, where I think Tayyip Erdogan overplayed his hand and said, you know, if you, we will solve the Cyprus problem if you can guarantee that we will go in. Now, Cyprus is important for the Europeans, but not to the point of giving a carte blanche to the Turks with respect to entry. It's interesting that Barroso talked about today how negotiations are different from accession. He said negotiations should continue, but accession is open-ended. He felt the need to remind everybody immediately after the elections today, according to a report I saw. Now, then we had the Hague effort, and that didn't get anywhere, and ultimately the Bürgerstock effort, without getting bogged down in the details. To cut a long story short, over the past 3 years, Mr. Erdogan and his colleagues have been more intent in stressing the advances made by the Turkish Cypriots and the Turkish Cypriot state, which is only recognized by Turkey, than the advantages of a settlement with the Greek Cypriots. This party is not as committed, or it does not appear to be as committed, to pushing ahead with this issue, but merely trying to, emphasize the Turkish Cypriot advances, as I said, and B, to point out to the Europeans the injustice of what was done, which is to allow the Greek Cypriots in the name of the entire island, even though they had voted against the referendum. But we are where we are, and it's quite clear that Turkey simply cannot move ahead without dealing, in one form or another, with the help of the Europeans themselves, with the Cyprus issue. But quite honestly, maybe because I was actually born in Cyprus and dealt with the Cyprus issue for so many years, I'm not optimistic about the way things are going to go. It seems advantageous for the Greek Cypriots, or at least the current Cypriot leadership, Greek Cypriot leadership under Mr. Papadopoulos, to score points against the Turks on the ports and airports issue, than to bite the bullet and settle for less than what they want to in the south. And the Turkish Cypriots don't seem quite clear as to how they're going to move on this issue. So the Europeans have a problem, and as Merkel confessed a couple of weeks back, maybe it was a mistake to let Cyprus in without its resolution, but that's where we are. Right at the back, please.
I don't anticipate much change in the administration's approach to this issue, which is, as a matter of record, is to be against it. I don't think that that'll change as a result of the elections, nor the prospect of its being passed becoming more imminent. It may be that they will lose this one, and I think that the Turks will have plenty of opportunity to see it coming, if it's coming. Your first question I didn't fully understand, so I'd ask you to repeat it. I'm absolutely convinced it will set back for years the prospect that Turkey would make any serious moves towards reconciliation over that issue. I don't know that you have a different view.
No. How can it lessen the problem?
I think I answered that. How will the U.S. government prepare the Turkish government for the problem? Oh, if it happens, how will we? I think that the administration will have little choice but to count on the Turkish government's own sense of self-interest to mitigate the consequences. I mean, Turkey will respond, I think, because popular opinion in Turkey will leave it no choice but to respond. But most of the things that have been discussed by which Turkey could respond would be negative for Turkey as well as for the United States. And so there's obviously reluctance on the part of Turkey even to get into that discussion, which I fully understand. But that there would be some response, I have no doubt whatsoever.
Well, I'll just add something to the debate. The U.S. government being opposed to the resolution could claim legitimately that the situation is somewhat similar to what happened in 2003 on the Turkish side, when it was the Turkish National Assembly that voted against allowing U.S. troops to attack Iraq from the north. But nonetheless, the Turkish government, having made that point, wanted a good relationship with the United States. Now, in this case, the U.S. could say it's the legislature that moved on this issue.
It will be highly effective at the time.
Well, we will see. We will see. But, you know, without putting ideas in Doug Silliman and his colleagues' heads, I mean, this is, I think, the way that the U.S. government is going to play it. If it passes, it will say we opposed it. We do not believe this is a good deal. But nonetheless, that's what happened in the House of Representatives. So, you know, let's hope the relationship will survive. How effective that will be at the other end, we will see. I think we've got about 10 minutes. Any more questions? One at the end. Go on. And you had one, Francis and Kiefer, too. We'll take two additional questions from people who asked questions before, and then we'll wrap up. Go ahead. If I said that, I was remiss in saying that religiosity was part of it, but a discussion of how religiosity, greater religiosity, fits in or doesn't fit in with the rigidly secular system was not part of the debate. You know, I was hoping that there would be more of a discussion of this in order to eradicate it. Look, I think that people voted for people who are as religious as they are, as observant as they are. I mean, that picture of Tayyip Erdogan and Abdullah Gül with their wives in the post-election celebrations, both of them wearing headscarves, was quite striking. Now, I know that annoyed a lot of people who do not, view headscarves to be part of the national scene. Religiosity, I think, is a part of the Turkish political picture. It has been ever since the 1950 elections in different forms. Now I think it's moved into a new phase. And the question is whether, as the person who was being interviewed by the BBC before me, they say, look, the counter-revolution has won. The Turkey as we've known it is gone. Either we accept this or the military intervenes on our behalf, which is pretty much what he said, or a new compromise, a new consensus, achieved perhaps by Tayyip Erdogan, leading from the top, saying, yes, indeed, we're religious, but, you know, we, as he said, I represent everybody. You know, we're reaching out to those who did not vote for us. And maybe a way could be found to end this gap between those who believe strongly and those who don't believe as strongly, those who manifest that belief through the wearing of headscarves and going to religious schools and so on, and those who do not. We can exaggerate the extent of polarization in Turkey, but nonetheless, it's there. And the question is whether they will deal with that problem of the change in Turkish society from the days of Kemal Atatürk to where we are now in a peaceful way through a modus vivendi, an accord that everybody will accept, or through some tension of the kind that we had a preview of in April. Go ahead. I think yours is the last question.
I don't know. It's a short answer. Putin will not be president forever is the second part of the answer. Here's how this could happen. Strained relations with the United States, which get worse as the administration reaches its end here and as these issues that I described come onto the agenda, and we have difficulty finding common ground on the one hand. and the Europeans being unresponsive to Tayyip Erdogan's renewed efforts to try to get that relationship going on the other. So you're left sort of faute de mieux with relatively few options in the region. And if you extrapolate the progress that's been made in Turkish-Russian relations over the past 3 or 4 years into that kind of a future, you know, I think you'd be silly not to at least build in the possibility that they could find areas of common ground. It's clear, for example, that the U.S.-Turkish energy transportation dialogue is breaking down. It's breaking down because we haven't been able to deliver. It's breaking down because other parties are, including, by the way, the Russians. So I suspect that unless something happens in this town to convince the Turks that we're going to play that game more effectively and persuasively, you know, that's an area that's already softening before our eyes.
Now, I can't resist adding something to this myself before ending it. A few weeks ago, we had a meeting on Russian-Turkish energy cooperation, and the point that I made was that the original idea for the East-West Corridor was that it would end the Russian monopoly and obviate the need for Iran, and that it would bring all sorts of benefits, and Ambassador Paris as ambassador in Turkey, and Doug Silliman, sitting where he sits at the department, have pushed very hard for the concept of the East-West Corridor, which Baku-Ceyhan oil pipeline and the gas pipeline that's been built to bring Shahdin's gas to Turkey have been important components. But if you look at the figures, the north-south axis has become just as important for Turkey, if not arguably more important. And the question has to be asked whether the original U.S.-Turkish cooperation to build the East-West Corridor needs to be readdressed along the lines of what Ambassador Paris is saying, and maybe brought up to date, taking into account all the changes that have occurred. And frankly, I doubt whether this administration here is going to be able to do it, but the next administration will certainly have to address this issue. Before I bring the meeting to an end, I've been remiss in one more thing. I did not identify Ambassador Paris as being at the Brookings and being focused on Turkey through the Turkey 2007 program, for which I apologize. And with that, I'd like to thank him again.
And if you're interested in looking at this again after the dust settles, we'll be having an event on the 31st of July with Soli Özel, who's coming in to give us a sort of more considered assessment of what this all means. So we hope that
you mean
we'll
even more considered.
So I'm part of it.
With that, I'd like to thank Ambassador Paris and all of you for coming. Thank you.